Brown, Khalid, and Swae Lee.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Researchers around the world are trying to find out how much and where COVID-19 is spreading in the wild. For researcher Todd Coutts and his team, that means giving COVID tests to animals like bears, moose, deer, and wolves. They are doing their research on a Native American reservation in the North Woods of Grand Portage, Minnesota, close to Canada. Scientists are concerned that the virus could change within animal populations. That could possibly create dangerous new viral mutations that could jump back to humans and spread among people. The pandemic has shown that the health of humans and animals is closely related. Exactly how the virus started has never been proven. But many scientists say it likely jumped from bats to humans. It could also have jumped to humans directly, or through another animal that was being sold live in Wuhan, China. Now the virus has been confirmed in wildlife in 24 states in the United States, including Minnesota. Recently, a Canadian study showed someone in nearby Ontario likely got a highly mutated form of the virus from a deer. If the virus can establish itself in a wild animal reservoir, it will always be out there with the threat to spill back into the human population, said Matthew Aliota. He is a researcher with the University of Minnesota, working with the Grand Portage Reservation Team. E.J. Isaac is a fish and wildlife scientist. He said the risk of the virus mutating grows with the start of spring, when bears wake from hibernation and deer and wolves move to different areas. He said more movement among animals increases the chance of transmission. The team's research carries its own set of risks. Sometimes they must capture animals from the air using a helicopter. They target animals like deer and moose from the air with a net gun. Researchers then test the animal's nose for COVID and put a tracking device on it. Another time, Coutts had to enter a bear's den while it was hibernating in order to test it. After testing the bear, Coutts sent the samples to a lab. He hopes to learn not just which animals are getting infected, but also whether certain animals are more likely to spread the virus to other species. Close contact between humans and animals has permitted the virus to defeat barriers to spread between species. To infect any living thing, the virus must get into its cells, which is not always easy. Virus expert David O'Connor compares the process to opening a lock with the virus's spike protein, key. Different species have different-looking locks, and some of those locks are not going to be openable by the key, the University of Wisconsin-Madison scientist said. But other locks are similar enough for the virus to enter an animal's cells and make copies of itself. As it does, it can mutate and still have a key that fits into the human lock. That permits it to go back to humans through close contact with live animals, scientists believe. It is rare for a virus to spread from animals to humans, but it only takes one person to bring a mutated virus to the world of humans. Some scientists think the Omicron variant of the coronavirus came from an animal rather than a human. What scientists are mostly concerned about is variants spreading widely within a species that comes in contact with humans, like deer. Scientists found the coronavirus in a third of deer tested in Iowa between September 2020 and January 2021. Other studies found virus antibodies in a third of deer tested in Illinois, Michigan, New York, and Pennsylvania. I'm Dan Novak.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences said Wednesday that actor Will Smith refused to leave after hitting Chris Rock at Sunday's Oscars ceremony. The Academy said it is considering actions against Smith for violating the group's standards of conduct. Such actions could include suspension, removal from the Academy, or other measures. During the ceremony seen live around the world, Smith walked up to the stage and hit presenter Chris Rock in the face with his open hand. Rock had made a joke about the appearance of Smith's wife, actor Jada Pinkett Smith. Rock's joke related to Pinkett Smith's hairless head. She has a medical condition that affects hair growth. Rock, a comedian, had also directed a joke at Pinkett Smith during the 2016 Oscars ceremony. People have wondered why Smith was permitted to stay after the incident and receive his Oscar for Best Actor. On Wednesday, the Academy suggested that it attempted to remove Smith from the ceremony. The group said in a statement, Mr. Smith was asked to leave the ceremony and refused. The Academy added that Smith could offer a written defense before the group meets again on April 18th. The Academy also apologized to Chris Rock, people at the event, and viewers of the broadcast. Smith's representative did not answer requests for comment on Wednesday. Smith had offered his own apology on Monday to Rock, the Academy, and viewers. He said, "I was out of line and I was wrong." Pinkett Smith has not commented on the incident so far. She posted on Instagram, "This is a season of healing, and I'm here for it." At a performance late Wednesday night in Boston, Rock said, "I'm still processing what happened, so at some point I'll talk about that." Only a very small number of members have ever been removed from the Academy. They include producer Harvey Weinstein, director Roman Polanski, and actors Bill Cosby and Carmine Caridi. Whoopi Goldberg, a well-known entertainer, is also a member of the Academy's Board of Governors. On her show The View, Monday, she said, "We are not going to take that Oscar from him." The Academy has not asked those removed from the group to return their Oscars. Goldberg added that nobody is okay with what happened. Wanda Sykes co-hosted the 2022 Oscars with Amy Schumer and Regina Hall. She said she felt physically ill after Smith hit Rock. In a discussion with Ellen DeGeneres that will air on April 7th, Sykes also said letting Smith stay and accept his Oscar should not have happened.
Imagine you want to talk about your life. Perhaps you are talking to a friend, presenting to an English class, or writing about your childhood. You might start with where your life began, in other words, where and when you were born. In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore how one famous writer wrote about the place and time of a birth. You will learn about some of the grammar behind the opening lines of one of the 20th century's most famous works of literature, Midnight's Children, by Salman Rushdie. The opening lines from Midnight's Children set up an important idea that runs through the book. That is, the words link the life and times of the main character to the history of India. Notice how the sentences jump between past and present, a clear suggestion that the narrator is in the process of writing about his life.
I was born in the city of Bombay. Once upon a time, no, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. I was born in Dr. Narlikar's nursing home on August 15th, 1947.
Note that the first sentence uses the simple past, I was. The adjective born follows the be verb, I was born in the city of Bombay. But then there is an expression that ends the sentence. It is, once upon a time. This is a common structure used in fairy tales or folk tales. The next sentence introduces the present tense, suggesting the narrator is talking to himself. Then it switches back to a more exact time during the past.
No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. I was born in Dr. Narlikar's nursing home on August 15th, 1947.
Having described where he was born, the narrator then describes when he was born.
And the time? The time matters too. Well then, at night. No, it's important to be more on the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact.
Note that Rushdie used some incomplete sentences, sentences without a verb. Examples include, and the time? Well then, at night. And on the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact. All of these statements bring an everyday, conversational quality to the story. But then Rushdie presents a beautiful image to the reader, one that changes back to the simple past.
Clock hands joined palms in respectful greeting as I came. Oh, spell it out, spell it out. At the precise instant of India's arrival at independence, I tumbled forth into the world.
The verb tumble means to move in a fast, confused, or uncontrolled way. It is often followed by an adverb, in this case, forth, which means out into notice or view. I tumbled forth into the world is a poetic way of saying I was born. Notice that Rushdie's opening lines follow a very clear structure. These lines start with a general statement and then get increasingly specific. The very general statement is, I was born in the city of Bombay. The more specific statement is, I was born in Dr. Narlikar's nursing home on August 15th, 1947. You can use the idea of moving from general information to specific information in almost any situation. Describing an event, writing a story, giving a presentation, and so on. Let's end this report with a homework assignment. In 5 to 8 sentences, write about the place or time of a birth. It can be either true or fictional. Try to use ideas that you have learned about in today's report. Send your writing to our email address, learningenglish@voanews.com. We will select one piece of writing and provide feedback and suggestions on next week's report. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the period known as the Cold War. The Cold War began after World War II. The main enemies were the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War got its name because both sides were afraid of fighting each other directly. In a hot war, nuclear weapons might destroy everything. So instead, both sides fought each other indirectly. They supported opposing sides in conflicts in different parts of the world. They also used words as weapons. They threatened and denounced each other, or they tried to make each other look foolish. Over the years, leaders on both sides changed, yet the Cold War continued. It was the major force in world politics for most of the second half of the 20th century. The Cold War world was separated into three groups. The United States led the West. This group included countries with democratic political systems. The Soviet Union led the East. This group included countries with communist political systems. The non-aligned group included countries that did not want to be tied to either the West or the East. Harry Truman was the first American president to fight the Cold War. He used several policies. One was the Truman Doctrine. This was a plan to give money and military aid to countries threatened by communism. The Truman Doctrine effectively stopped communists from taking control of Greece and Turkey. Another policy was the Marshall Plan. This strengthened the economies and governments of countries in Western Europe. A major event in the Cold War was the Berlin Airlift. After World War II, the United States and its allies divided Germany. Berlin was a part of communist East Germany. The city was divided into East and West. In June 1948, Soviet-led forces blocked all roads and railways leading to the western part of Berlin. President Truman quickly ordered military airplanes to fly coal, food, and medicine to the city. The planes kept coming, sometimes landing every few minutes for more than a year. The United States received help from Britain and France. Together, they provided almost 2.5 million tons of supplies on about 280,000 flights. The United States also led the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 1949. NATO was a joint military group. Its purpose was to defend against Soviet forces in Europe. The Soviet Union and its East European allies formed their own joint military group, the Warsaw Pact, 6 years later. In 1953, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin died. His death gave the new American president, Dwight Eisenhower, a chance to deal with new Soviet leaders. In July 1955, Eisenhower and Nikolai Bulganin met in Geneva, Switzerland. The leaders of Britain and France also attended. Eisenhower proposed that the Americans and Soviets agree to let their military bases be inspected by air by the other side. The Soviets later rejected the proposal. Yet, the meeting in Geneva was not considered a failure. After all, the leaders of the world's most powerful nations had shaken hands. Cold War tensions increased, then eased, then increased again over the years. The changes came as both sides attempted to influence political and economic developments around the world. For example, the Soviet Union provided military, economic, and technical aid to communist governments in Asia. The United States then helped 8 Asian nations fight communism by establishing the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, known as CETO. In the 1950s, the United States began sending military advisors to help South Vietnam defend itself against communist North Vietnam. That aid would later expand into a long and bloody period of American involvement in Vietnam. The Cold War also affected the Middle East. In the 1950s, both East and West offered aid to Egypt to build the Aswan High Dam on the Nile River. The West canceled its offer, however, after Egypt bought weapons from the communist government in Czechoslovakia. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser then seized control of the company that operated the Suez Canal. A few months later, Israel invaded Egypt. France and Britain joined the invasion. For once, the United States and the Soviet Union agreed on a major issue. Both supported a United Nations resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire. The Suez Crisis was a political victory for the Soviets. When the Soviet Union supported Egypt, it gained new friends in the Arab world. In 1959, Cold War tensions eased a little. The new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, visited Dwight Eisenhower in the United States. The meeting was very friendly. But the next year, relations got worse again. An American U-2 reconnaissance airplane was shot down over the Soviet Union. The plane and its pilot, Francis Gary Powers, were captured. Eisenhower admitted that such planes had been spying on the Soviets for years. In a speech at the United Nations, Khrushchev got so angry that he took off his shoe and beat it on a table. John F. Kennedy followed Eisenhower as president in 1961. During his early days in office, Cuban exiles invaded Cuba. It came to be known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. The forces wanted to oust the communist government of Fidel Castro. America's Central Intelligence Agency had provided training for the exiles. But the United States failed to send military planes to protect them during the invasion. As a result, almost all were killed or taken prisoner by Cuban forces trained and supported by the Soviet Union and Soviet allied nations. At the same time in Europe, tens of thousands of East Germans had been fleeing to the West. East Germany's government decided to stop them. It built a wall separating the eastern and western parts of the city of Berlin. Guards shot at anyone who tried to flee by climbing over. During Kennedy's second year in office, American intelligence reports discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
The Soviet Union denied the missiles were there. Yet American photographs taken from high in the air proved they were. America's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no?
Mr. Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
The Cuban Missile Crisis easily could have resulted in a nuclear war. Americans felt especially threatened with those missiles just 150 kilometers from the Florida coast. But the crisis ended after a week. Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles if the United States agreed not to interfere in Cuba. Some progress was made in easing Cold War tensions when Kennedy was president. In 1963, the two sides reached a major arms control agreement. They agreed to ban tests of nuclear weapons above ground, underwater, and in space. They also established a direct telephone link between the White House and the Kremlin. Relations between East and West also improved when Richard Nixon was president. He and Leonid Brezhnev met several times. They reached several arms control agreements. One reduced the number of missiles used to shoot down enemy nuclear weapons. It also banned the testing and deployment of long-distance missiles for 5 years. A major change in the Cold War would take place in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union. He met four times with President Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev withdrew Soviet forces from Afghanistan, and he signed an agreement with the United States to destroy all middle-distance and short-distance nuclear missiles. By 1989, there was widespread unrest in Eastern Europe. Gorbachev did not intervene as one Eastern European country after another cut its ties with the Soviet Union. The Berlin Wall, the major symbol of communist oppression, was torn down in November of that year. In less than a year, East and West Germany became one nation again. A few months after that, Warsaw Pact countries officially ended the alliance. The Cold War was over.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.